one of my mission statements, if you will, was to create a film that had the feeling of reading Baldwin. And I think the feeling of reading Baldwin is this constant shift of perspective and this constant wave of moves. And so I think the film and its construction is like this cascading wave of movements of emotions and states of mind.
Film director Barry Jenkins on his new movie, If Beale Street Could Talk. We'll speak with him later on in the show. First, though, Maria Butina pled guilty today. She spent years trying to gain influence with conservatives, especially the NRA, in order to influence the 2016 presidential election. Her guilty plea is not part of Robert Mueller's investigation, but she did try hard to broker a secret meeting between Donald Trump when he was a candidate and Russian President Vladimir Putin. And speaking of Trump, American Media Incorporated, the parent company of the National Enquirer, has admitted to paying off a Playboy model to protect Donald Trump's campaign. Here to talk about all of this is Yoni Applebaum, Washington bureau chief at The Atlantic. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, nice to be with you again.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin with Maria Butina. What did she plead guilty to exactly?
Well, she pled guilty to acting as an agent of a foreign government without registering and a couple more minor things. But what she did, and this is interesting, is she exploited the soft underbelly of influence peddling in this city in Washington. She came at the Republican establishment through the National Rifle Association, through the prayer breakfast, through these groups that don't vet the folks who are involved with them as much as the people she was trying to get to ordinarily would. And she was remarkably effective.
What was the ultimate goal?
You know, it's a little hard to parse it from the pleading documents that we have. If you look at it in the longer term, what she's accused of by the government is trying to influence the Republican Party. She was targeting specifically the Republican Party, presumably to get it to soften its stance on Russia and in particular on sanctions. And so this is a multi-year effort to exploit the American political system in ways that will ultimately redound to Russia's credit and benefit.
And is she connected in any way to Donald Trump's presidential campaign?
I think the only fair answer to that is we don't know, but there's no direct indication of it. In fact, one of the things that came out of all the reporting on Butina and now this latest guilty plea is that she clearly hadn't known the way very few of us knew that Donald Trump was going to emerge as the nominee. So she goes to Scott Walker's kickoff. She's prospecting for the next Republican presidential candidate and trying to ingratiate herself and does make an effort to ingratiate herself with Trump. But she's clearly not aware in advance who's going to win it and is hedging her bets by insinuating herself into these influence peddling organizations so that she'll be in a position to influence the Republican administration no matter who picks up the nomination.
And she's not alone in this, right? She's working with a guy named Alexander Torshin, who is one of the Russians sanctioned by the U.S. government. Tell us about their connection.
Well, welcome to the world of Russian influence and intrigue. Torshin technically is the deputy chair of the Russian Central Bank, which wouldn't sound ordinarily like a good position to exercise a espionage operation. But Putin surrounds himself with folks who freelance and attempts to do these things on behalf of the Russian government. It's a nebulous world. She certainly was working at Torshin's direction. There are strong indications here, including in the charging documents, that at some point the FSB, that the Russian espionage service, gets involved in this as well. And so although it was a one-to-one relationship of mentor and mentee, it is simultaneously a Putin confidant working to advance Russia's interests in a way that he presumably thinks is going to help him within Russia's inner circle.
Okay, so moving on to AMI, how significant is it that this media company admitted to basically buying Playboy model Karen McDougal's story, this sort of catch and kill thing, in an effort to protect Donald Trump's campaign?
Well, this is a big deal, and I think actually it's hard to overstate how big a deal it is. The catch in this story has always been the demonstration of intent. So it was quite clear that there were violations of campaign finance laws here, that AMI, particularly in as much as they had wanted to be reimbursed by Michael Cohen for these expenses, and Cohen then pays off a second woman on his own and gets reimbursed by the Trump Organization. There's clearly money moving around in ways that violate the statutes. The trick on the statutes is that it's a civil violation if you can simply document it. It becomes a criminal matter if you can demonstrate knowledge and intent. And that's a really deliberately high standard. It's really, really hard to get there. What you would want is either the offender himself or people in the room with the offender to tell you, well, we did this specifically to help the campaign. That was our primary motivation. You want to be able to demonstrate that, and we now know that Michael Cohen has told prosecutors that that's the case, and that apparently AMI has agreed that that was the case. NBC is reporting this afternoon that the third person in the room identified in these documents as a member of the Trump campaign, what was the member of the Trump campaign, was the President of the United States. And so if, in fact, prosecutors have direct testimony from two of the three participants in that meeting saying that this was a scheme devised to circumvent campaign finance laws and cover up something which the American people might otherwise have weighed before they went to the polls and voted, that's a very big deal.
Very big deal. Is President Trump saying anything about that? Is he saying that he wasn't at that meeting, or he doesn't remember what was said there, or what, anything at all?
Well, as is his wont, he has said many things on the subject. Remember that originally he denied any knowledge of the payment whatsoever. That was back in April.
Yeah.
His story has evolved five or six times since then. The latest version, which he's offered on Twitter, is essentially, I didn't do this, and if I did this, I did it at the advice of my attorney, and it's his fault. And anyway, it's just a civil matter. That gives us some hint of what his eventual defense here is going to be, that he was doing this either at the advice of counsel and so didn't really understand that he was breaking the law, or that he was doing it for personal reasons. But with the direct testimony of the two other participants, that will be a very high hurdle for him to clear if he were to face criminal charges as a result of this, which is entirely plausible.
Well, Yoni, thank you very much.
Always a pleasure.
Yoni Applebaum is Washington Bureau Chief at The Atlantic. $2.5 million. That's how much the former editor-in-chief and publisher of the LA Times, Devon Maharaj, received in a secret payout from the paper's former parent company, Tronc, now Tribune Publishing. Apparently, Maharaj taped Tribune's former chairman, Michael Farrow, making an anti-Semitic comment about LA billionaire Eli Broad. Maharaj's multi-million dollar payout came as Tribune was undergoing massive layoffs and losing revenue. We're going to talk about this now with NPR's David Folkenflik, who broke the story, and also with Carolina Miranda. She's a familiar voice to us here because she's a regular on Press Play, and she's also a union rep at the LA Times. Hi, both of you.
Hey, Madeline.
Hi.
Okay. First, what did Farrow say on this recording?
So this is an account given to me in separate interviews by two people who say they heard it. It was at an event in 2016, a dinner of top Tronc executives and top news executives and publishers from the newspapers, the major newspapers that make up the newspaper chain. So they had about 20 folks there, and Farrow, as he tends to do, holds forth, and he talks about his somewhat audacious intentions for the company, digital innovation and the like. And in so doing, as I'm told was his practice on occasion, he talked about people he thought of as competitors, as business impediments, the like. And he referred to the civic leader Eli Broad, a developer, a billionaire, a major political player there. He said that he was part of a Jewish cabal that runs L.A., and so you have this scenario where Maharaj is fired in August of 2017, and soon after that decides to put together a possible wrongful termination lawsuit. He goes to mediation with Tronc Tribune Publishing, take your pick for the name, and the mediator, according to a person with knowledge of the incident, tells Tronc officials, after hearing a sampling of the tape that includes the cabal line, hey, you're going to want to pay money to keep that out of the public eye. You're going to want to settle this settlement. Now, the settlement is essentially to avert the wrongful termination lawsuit. It has the consequence of ensuring that that statement was kept from the public eye and ear.
Was that part of the settlement, that Maharaj would agree not to make that public in exchange for the money?
Well, I think the way to look at it is the entire settlement was confidential, including the existence of it. Nobody knew about the settlement. Not only the size, but the fact of the settlement was not disclosed to Los Angeles Times staff and not disclosed to the shareholders of Tribune Company. The amount, you know, is not incidental. It's in excess of $2.5 million in total. That wasn't disclosed.
Carolina, so what happened when you and the rest of the staff heard David's story yesterday?
Well, there was definitely a moment in which all work at the LA Times ceased. I would say it was quite a revealing report. You know, if there was anyone out there who was wondering why the reporters of the LA Times unionized, certainly David's report confirms why. And I think while we were unionizing, while we were undertaking the campaign, we were looking into questions of executive compensation and these bonuses that people like Farrow were paying to themselves, and the fact that figures such as Ross Levinson, the publisher and CEO, were earning outside wages in comparison to comparative positions, say, at the New York Times Company. And we were looking into all of those things, and some of the other stuff was certainly whispers in terms of the behavior, sexual harassment allegations that came out, all of those things. But there was a sense that I think we had to protect ourselves from what was happening at the top.
So has there been any official reaction on the part of the new editor, on the part of the new publisher to this report?
Well, Patrick Soon-Shiong gave a statement, the new owner, he gave a statement to Meg James, who did a follow-up story in the LA Times about it, and he really, he said that Trunk is behind us and it's time to look forward. But I think for the staff, it's still, the whole Trunk era is still this wound that has not entirely healed, and we're still living in many ways with the after effects. And I think people were angry that so much money was being spent on bonuses, on this settlement at a time in which people were being laid off, in which cutbacks were being made in the newsroom. There is certainly the question of a reporter who may have been aware of malfeasance, you know, using that for a settlement rather than exposing it.
And meanwhile, David, Michael Farrow is still the largest shareholder of Tribune, right?
That's right. He stepped back as the chairman of the board back in March on the day that Fortune magazine revealed sexual harassment accusations against him stemming from interactions with women he met, not from the Tribune publishing world, but other business associates. But Farrow tried to sell his stake, and that sale fell through. So he remains over 25%, the largest shareholder. The second largest shareholder, if I'm not mistaken, is Patrick Soon-Shiong, who is the owner of the now privately held LA Times. So it's they are still tethered together as long as the company exists, but are rivals in some ways, as well as business partners in Tribune Publishing.
How appropriate that there are sirens out there, because it's
they're coming for me now.
Well, the company is on fire, I guess.
There is that. I think some of the points the Guild have raised early on have turned out to be interesting ones. Oftentimes you hear people and unions talk about executive compensation, and sometimes it's a frustratingly large gap for workers between what executives are paid and what employees are. In the case of Tribune Publishing, it's a troubled company in what is already a troubled industry. The legacy that was burdened with this company before Farrow showed up meant that it was already in real problematic situation and circumstances. But let me just say that, the amount of compensation at various points promised and given to a number of the most senior executives, Farrow getting not only certain kinds of compensation, but also being promised $15 million, later lowered to $12.5 million, as consulting fees when he was already the chairman and the controlling owner of the company. Just seems staggering. Ross Levinson, who was for a brief time the LA Times publisher and CEO under Trunk, and then is now Trunk's and Tribune's chief digital officer, really receiving an incredible amount of money. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that he'd get more than $10 million if the company were to be sold by the end of the year. Hmm. You're talking about a time at which I think it's very germane to the bottom line of this company to see, you know, where the money goes and where the money flows.
And I think, you know, if I could add to that, you know, this is a time in which LA Times, the LA Times newsroom was being asked to make a lot of sacrifices. They were cutting back on travel. There was attrition. There had been, just in the 4 years I've been at the Times, there's been, at the Times, I think there's been at least three waves of buyouts. And so this is a period, you know, one of the things that we turned up when we were campaigning and looking into the SEC filings and looking at the at some of the compensation issues is figures like Michael Farrow employing a private jet. And, you know, how many newspaper directors mm-hmm. have directors of newspaper companies have private jets? And then not only us, the company paying for a private jet, but we were reimbursing his own firm for the use of that private jet. So he's making money to take the private jet.
Yeah, it's just unbelievable. Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us today.
You bet.
Thank you for having us.
Carolina Miranda, co-chair of the LA Times Guild, staff writer at the paper, and David Folkenflik, media correspondent at NPR News. Coming up in the program, advice for how to cope during this festive season when you're not feeling festive. That's next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The holidays can be stressful. They can be triggering for people going through a tough time, maybe a recent death or illness in the family. All this forced good cheer can just exacerbate their sorrow. Well, here to talk about how to ease the pain is Steve Leader, senior rabbi at the Wilshire Boulevard Temple and the author of the book, More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So I understand that you suffered a loss recently. Your father died.
Yes.
And we've just come out of Thanksgiving. How was Thanksgiving for you?
Thanksgiving was underwhelming for me. Now, I think the buildup very, very rarely delivers the payoff people expect for Thanksgiving, even under the best of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after about 3 minutes, you realize you don't have much to say to your cousin from Akron who's in the tire recycling business or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But for me, Thanksgiving was underwhelming. Now, we did make some good decisions. In addition to my father dying recently, my wife was diagnosed with breast cancer about 2 weeks before Thanksgiving.
Oh, my gosh.
And we were in the throes of all of that. So the first good decision we made was we are not doing anything at our home. It's too much stress. It's too much work. And we're just not doing it.
Hmm.
So lesson number one is really honor the emotional space that you're inhabiting during the holidays. If you've had a terrible loss, if you're suffering, you know, be kind to yourself and say no. You know, I often say behind every no, there's a yes.
And what is the yes in that circumstance?
The yes in that circumstance is mitigating the stress in your life, being careful about your energy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, grief is exhausting. It is utterly exhausting. And if you don't give that grief the physical and emotional resources required, it will just sink you lower and lower and lower.
But so isn't there also the case for being around people because withdrawing can make you even more depressed?
I think there is a case for being around the right people. The people around whom you do not have to pretend to be happy or okay. The people who will allow you the space within whatever, for lack of a better word, celebration. And I think gathering for people who are suffering during the holidays is a better notion than celebration. The people who will grant the opportunity to take a moment not only to express what we're grateful for example, but also what we miss so terribly. The people who will grant the opportunity to hang an ornament on the Christmas tree that reminds you of that absence that is so present during the holidays. people who will allow a moment to pause and to light that candle in honor of, you know, a loved one who's died. People who will hold hands with you and support your effort to remain sober, for example. You know, for addicts, this is a horrible, horrible time of year for many of them. And there's a tremendous spike in relapse. Ask anyone in the addiction community. There's a tremendous spike in relapse this time of year. So it's about being with the right people who really understand. I agree with you that completely isolating yourself is often, there are times when that's appropriate, but often the wrong way to go. But also putting yourself on some kind of phony stage for the holidays is really terribly unkind to yourself and not very productive.
Now, you have written that the ancient rabbis actually forbade people from attending weddings or other celebrations for a year after suffering a loss.
Correct. Well, that's in the case of parents. In the case of the death of a parent, you're actually forbidden to attend celebrations for a year. In the case of other relatives, it's usually at least 30 days. Now, a lot of people think this prohibition against being at celebrations was somehow mandated because it was viewed as being disrespectful to the deceased.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong. It's disrespectful to the mourners. Do not put yourself in those kinds of positions. It's unfair to be around happy, dancing people when you're neither. And this gives the tradition, gives permission. It's permission granted to just hunker down, you know, to feel as wounded as you are, to take the time to heal, both physically and emotionally. And the way I kind of put this in the book, it's very glib, but I also think it's about as perfect as could be. You know, when you're suffering and you say no to things, the people who really matter don't mind. And the people who mind, they really don't matter.
What is the responsibility for on the part of the happy people, the happy dancing people, when they know that, for instance, they're inviting you to a celebration and they know that your father has passed, your wife has been diagnosed? What is their responsibility?
Well, let me start with what they should not do. Okay, let's start with the 7 words you should never say to someone who's suffering. And those 7 words are, let me know if you need anything. It's terrible.
Because that puts the responsibility on
them. It puts
the
burden on the person who's suffering. Most people don't even mean it when they say it. It's kabuki. And even if they do mean it, again, you're giving more homework to the person who's suffering who's probably not going to tell you in the first place anyway. I would reach out and anticipate what the person needs. It's our job not to ask them what they need. It's our job to imagine, if I were in Madeline's shoes, what is it that would be helpful to me? So things, for example, like we'd like to have you there. We're going to keep it very small so that it's comfortable for you. Here's who's coming. Are you okay with that? Right? We would like to pause and give you the opportunity to share a few memories about your dad. Is that all right with you? We'd like to honor your dad somehow as we're together. You know, again, I think this Christmas ornament idea is a really good one. You know, is there something of your dad's you'd like to put on our tree? We'd be honored to have it there. This is a real gift of the heart, you know, as opposed to pretending everything is okay. You know, there's an empty seat at the table for Hanukkah. There's an empty seat at the table for Christmas. And it's not just death. You might have a kid in trouble. You know, you might have a parent in a nursing home with Alzheimer's. You know, you might be struggling with your weight. You might be struggling with sobriety. There are many things that make the holidays a challenge. You may be recently divorced, which is so painful, both for parents and for children. So all of these things are an opportunity to reach out to someone else, you know, with real compassion and real sensitivity and real answers.
And as someone who is suffering, what should you say yes to?
Well, this is not a very satisfying answer, but it's true. It's the same thing Justice Potter Stewart said when he was asked to define obscenity by the Supreme Court. He said, I can't define it, but I know when I see it. And so I would say that I can't give you a simple generic answer to that question. What should a person say yes to when he or she is sort of in the depths of pain and suffering? I think you'll know it when you hear it. trust yourself, I guess, is my biggest piece of advice. Listen to yourself. And if it sounds like something that, you know, well, I think I would like that, then do it. Also, I think if you have a partner, a spouse, a friend who's going with you, have some kind of signal for when it's time to leave.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes a lot is terrible and a little is pretty nice. And let's just get rid of this expectation that everything is normal and happy and you're fine, because you're not fine. Why should you be?
And maybe don't buy so much stuff.
Well,
that's also be enervating.
This is the other thing is now, you know, we were talking earlier a little bit about my dad. So I don't know about you, but I was raised in the stop crying or I'll really give you something to cry about parenting school, which, you know, I didn't like much when I was a kid. However, there is something to be said for perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
And when about 5 years ago, I had very difficult spinal surgery and a very difficult recovery. I got briefly addicted to opioids. I was depressed. I was in a lot of pain. And it really was a pivotal moment in my life that taught me many, many things. In fact, I wrote the book partly because of how much that physical pain shocked me and how much better my life got when I finally started listening to it. And what I did that year during the holidays, instead of going to the countless parties to which I am invited to every year, my wife, Betsy, and I and our kids chose instead to go to OPCC right down the street from this studio, homeless shelter, and we served Christmas dinner. And we have a food pantry there that we operate every Sunday. So I've been there many times as a volunteer at the food pantry. But my misery was contextualized very differently
mm-hmm.
by volunteering in that homeless shelter. You know, there's this beautiful Chinese proverb that says, if you want to be happy for an hour, take a nap. If you want to be happy for a day, go fishing. If you want to be happy for a month, get married. If you want to be happy for a year, inherit a fortune. If you want to be happy for life, help another person. So even in the midst of our own suffering, we have the capacity to reach out to help a fellow sufferer. And in that reaching out, both of us are uplifted.
I want to thank you so much. This has been a gift for this holiday season to hear you and
thank
hear
you,
your words. So thank you.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. That's Rabbi Steve Leder. He's the author of More Beautiful Than Before, How Suffering Transforms Us. Coming up, filmmaker Barry Jenkins. His film Moonlight won Best Picture 2 years ago. Now he has a new movie out. It's based on a James Baldwin novel.
Baldwin is very difficult to adapt. You know, his obsession is not with linearity, you know, it's not with cause and effect, A to B to C. I think he's about showing you the cause and the effect and then unpacking that.
How Barry Jenkins made If Beale Street Could Talk, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Barry Jenkins' movie Moonlight won Best Picture after that initial mix-up you may recall at the Oscars 2 years ago. Well, now he has a new movie out that, of course, is eagerly anticipated. It's called If Beale Street Could Talk. It's an adaptation of a James Baldwin novel, a love story between young Tish and Fonny. While Fonny is in prison awaiting trial for a rape he did not commit, 19-year-old Tish finds out she's pregnant.
This is a sacrament. And no, I ain't lost my mind. We are drinking to new life. Tish gonna have Fonny's baby.
That's Tish's mom, played by Regina King. The family rallies around Tish and works hard to get Fonny out of prison in time for the birth. The story takes place in 1970s Harlem, much of it in flashback. Director Barry Jenkins joins me now. Welcome back.
Hey, nice to be back. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so this seems to be, initially, when you look at it, a love story with a huge obstacle thrown in the middle of it. Did you see it that way, as primarily a love story?
Yeah, I did. I did primarily a love story between Tish and Fonny, but also just an exploration of all these many different kinds of love. You know, both the parents for the children, you know, Tish and Fonny are parents who are expecting, and then just all the different dynamics, you know, brotherly love between friends. Brian Tyree Henry plays a character named Daniel Carty, who's going through the thing that Fonny potentially is going to go through by being forced into the system of mass incarceration. So, yeah, I saw the love story as sort of like the housing for all these many very intricate ideas that Mr. Baldwin was espousing about American society and the criminal justice system.
Let's talk about that scene between the two friends, between Fonny and Brian Tyree Henry. And they have a really intense conversation. And this is, again, one of the flashback scenes. So this is before Fonny goes to prison. And his friend is telling him, he's just gotten out, and he's telling him how bad it is, like worse than you can imagine. And I guess as a member of the audience, you know, you're filled with dread because you know what's awaiting Fonny. Fonny has no idea. Can you talk about that scene and how that came together and what you wanted to convey?
Yeah, you know, it's a scene in the novel. The novel is very nonlinear. Mr. Baldwin had a way of framing stories that was more about the reader experiencing them as an extension of consciousness of the main characters. And in the film, we place the sequence fully together. You know, we just have Brian Tyree Henry appears as this character, Daniel Carty. And as you said, Daniel has all these buried traumas. And over the course of the sequence, with he and Stephon James's character, Fonny, discussing all these things that have been laying dormant in a certain way, you see all these traumas, all this post-traumatic stress sort of rise to the surface. And in a way, I think for Fonny, it's a vision, you know, of what potentially could happen to a young man like himself.
So it's more than just a love story, right? I mean, or a story of different kinds of loves. It's also a commentary on the injustice of the criminal justice system when it comes to black men.
Yeah, I think so. I think Mr. Baldwin was, you know, through these characters, through the story, which is loosely based, I think, on, you know, actual elements that were happening around him that were prevalent amongst the black community during this day, which is the manipulation of the judicial system, both on the ground, you know, by the cops walking the beat, and then also, too, once these young men find themselves within the system, you know, the disparity between the sentences that one person receives for a crime and that another person receives for a crime. But like they say, you know, the best housing for an idea is a story. And I think the best housing for these kind of themes, these very elevated intellectual ideas about society, is to frame them through characters and through families.
Mm. And through a love story, and through a love story that perhaps can't be a happy love story, that because the two characters, the two lovers, can't be together.
Yeah, I think in a certain way, it's, you know, Mr. Baldwin's very hopeful sort of treatise on the power of love, the power of family, and the power of community. You know, these characters, and if Bill Street could talk, basically everything is thrown against them. Everything is thrown against them. But I think the love they have for one another, they're legitimately soulmates, I believe. That love is so strong that through it all, it does endure. In a bittersweet way, but I think it does endure.
And can you talk about why you wanted to adapt a novel by James Baldwin? Out of all of his work, why this novel, and why a novel of his and not something else, an essay or something?
Yeah, you know, I'd always loved the work of Mr. Baldwin. Ever since graduating undergrad, I kind of, you know, would always try to find whatever I could, you know, The Fire Next Time, Giovanni's Room, and things like that. And a friend sent me If Bill Street Could Talk, I guess maybe a decade into my obsession with James Baldwin. In this book, I found just the marriage of these two very distinct voices within Mr. Baldwin. One, as you said, you know, it's a love story. And I think in a certain way, Mr. Baldwin was obsessed, you know, and very passionate about sensuality, romance, interpersonal relationships. And I think on the other hand, he was also just equally obsessed with being very observant and very honest about American society and the role it played in the lives and souls of black folks, and very critical of the role that it played. And I think in this book, through the story of Tish and Fonny and this ordeal they find themselves in, it was the marriage of those two voices in what I thought was a very fluid, organic way. And I also thought, too, just visually, that it would be a very rapturous cinematic experience if we could pull it off.
What do you mean by that?
You know, Baldwin is very difficult to adapt. You know, his obsession is not with linearity. You know, it's not with, you know, cause and effect, A to B to C. I think he's about showing you the cause and the effect and then unpacking that and getting to the root of why, you know, cause A results in effect B, and then even more to the point, how that feels. And I think generationally, how these cause and effects are passed down from generation to generation. You know, it's a very slippery slippery thing. It's intellectual, and at the same time, it's also very emotional and evocative. And I think when you're painting with just sounds and images, which is ultimately what cinema does, those are the tools at your disposal, getting into that interior voice that Mr. Baldwin weaves so well, it's a very difficult thing to do.
And so that's why you go back and skip back and forth in time?
The novel is just as nonlinear as the film. I would say the novel is even more nonlinear than the film. But I think one of my mission statements, if you will, was to create a film that had the feeling of reading Baldwin. And I think the feeling of reading Baldwin is this constant shift of perspective and this constant wave of moves. And so I think the film and its construction is like this cascading wave of movements of emotions and states of mind. And I think that's what Mr. Baldwin did so well, you know, weaving those things in a certain way that this idea of passive empathy just doesn't apply to his work. You know, I think the way he constructs these states of mind and the way he frames the consciousness of his characters, it just it engenders an act of empathy on the part of the reader. And I hope the film does the same thing on the part of the viewer.
Yeah. And I know this might sound out of left field, but I heard that you spent a lot of time at the Curry James Marshall exhibition at MoCA Grand.
I did. How did you hear that? I did indeed. I live downtown and I'm a MoCA member.
From a well-placed source.
There you go. Yeah, it was a very, very inspiring exhibit. You know, I think with making films, inspiration comes from many different places. And I think this idea of the image needing to be a chaotic thing in order to be impactful just isn't true, to me at least. And I think in that exhibit, which was a wonderful exhibit, I saw it both here at MoCA and at the Met in New York multiple times. I think there's a power in the stillness of Mr. Marshall's images and all his work that I think was very inspirational for us in making Beale Street. James Laxon, the cinematographer, he saw it as well.
So you would go in and look at particular paintings and think about how you would want to shoot your scenes to, or they would inspire you in when you were conceptualizing certain scenes and how you wanted to shoot them?
Yeah, they would. You know, especially the scene between Brian Tyree Henry and Stephon James. You know, it's literally in a basement apartment and it spans the course of a day. And Mr. Marshall does really amazing work with pigmentation in his paintings, and he's not afraid to paint with a very dark canvas. And I knew that scene, as the day went on, the light would fade, and so we would be doing some ways the same thing, creating these portraits, these landscapes of Stephon and Brian's faces.
That's interesting you're talking about pigmentation, because Curry James Marshall, several of his portraits are of very, very dark skin faces. And in the Baldwin novel, the main character, the male, Fonny, is described as light-skinned. I wanted to know, first of all, why James Baldwin thought it was important to describe him as light-skinned. And then your actor, Stephon James, is not light-skinned. And so was that a decision that you made on purpose?
It was a decision I made, not necessarily on purpose, because I think saying on purpose implies intent. We did a casting search, and I was trying to find my Fonny to look exactly as described in the novel. But I often think casting should be a meritocracy. And Stephon James came in and gave an amazing audition. Oftentimes, a character, it'll be the opposite. A character is written dark-skinned and then somehow will end up cast light-skinned. Mm-hmm. And I think the very desultory reason for that is that we assume that as these movies travel out, not only in America, but also outside our borders, the audience is more willing to empathize with a lighter-skinned character. And so I thought, if we're going to flip this, you know, let's flip it the other way. And this wonderful thing came about from it, which was, you know, our story, as you said at the beginning, is a love story. And it's a very lush love story. And so to see these two very dark-skinned young people depicted as soulmates, you know, in the voice of James Baldwin, I've been to screenings where that in and of itself is so moving for a very particular audience member. And it didn't occur to me initially because, like I said, I didn't make the decision with that intent. But the result, I think, is something that's quite wonderful and quite beautiful. And I think worth sacrificing that one dynamic of the novel.
Were there any dynamics, other dynamics that you sacrificed or any other places that you diverged from the novel?
Yeah, the ending of the book is a little bit different than the ending of the novel, I would say. I just wanted a very concrete way to put forth what I think was the thesis of Mr. Baldwin's novel, especially with the opening quote that we have in the film, which was the strength of love, the strength of family, and this idea of a very grounded, realistic hope and optimism that comes from this foundation, you know, in the Black family. And so we altered the ending of the book just slightly.
So you see the ending as a happy ending?
I do in a certain way, because I think the situation that Fonny finds himself in, you know, Fonny's not falsely accused of anything. He's chosen out of a police lineup, and he's placed in a police lineup by a police officer who we very clearly see has a vendetta out against them. The odds are clearly stacked. And this is in 1974. You know, Stephon James speaks very eloquently about modeling his character, at least the psychology of his character somewhat, on the ordeal of Kalief Browder, you know, who was a young man who was charged with stealing a backpack that he did not steal and spent 3 years in Rikers Island, 2.5 in solitary confinement, ultimately was exonerated but committed suicide shortly thereafter. So that was, you know, 5 years ago. So I think in 1974, it was enough just for this cop to place Fonny in this police lineup and him to get picked out of it for him to actually do some time. And yet the family unit is not broken. The love between Tish and Fonny is not broken. The child is healthy. And it's a different life. You know, he has this great monologue where he speaks about building a great big table, you know, and our family's going to eat off it for a long, long time to come. I'm going to build us a great big table, he says. And so we see them at the end sitting at a great big table, not the one he built, but the family is still intact and the child is healthy and the love is still there. And so I think they will endure, just like, I mean, the history of Black folks in America is not a very pretty history. And the beginning of that history is certainly not rooted in anything that was quite generous to us. And yet here we are. I'm talking to you on KCRW. You know, and Mr. Baldwin's books exist and Black Panther exist. And so, yeah, I do think in a certain way it's a very grounded optimism and a very grounded hope.
I love that you call him Mr. Baldwin.
I have to. You know, if Terrell and I weren't the same age, I would call Terrell Mr. McCraney as well. You know, I think that, you know, adapting the work of these two men has been so humbling for me to be gifted with the characters that they created. You know, of course, I have to speak to them with respect.
Mr. Jenkins.
Not quite. I got a ways to go.
Barry Jenkins is the director of Moonlight and the new movie, If Beale Street Could Talk. The film opens in theaters this Friday. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Coming up, a pair of nuns embezzled money from the school they ran to run to Vegas and gamble. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. And now the story of two nuns who had a thing for gambling. They embezzled money from the Catholic school they ran in Torrance. And now parents are angry. They're furious. And the Archdiocese is struggling to manage the fallout. LA Times reporter Haley Branson Potts wrote about this. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, the initial figure quoted was $500,000 that they stole, but it might be a lot more than that. How are they doing this?
That's correct. So it's something that the Archdiocese and now parents are learning is that banks only keep checks for a few years at a time. So right now, the $500,000 amount is that's attributed to checks that they found since, I believe, 2012. Mm-hmm. One of the sisters was the principal for 29 years. So this could balloon.
So it could be that, like, decades worth of embezzling?
It could be.
Oh, my gosh.
They have yet to speculate about a number. I did speak to one mother whose children went there for 16 years. She was able to pull her own checks only back for 7 years, and these are tuition checks, all diverted into a false account. That was $45,000. Her children went to the school for 16 years.
And it's just one parent.
That's just one parent.
How was this discovered?
So this was discovered discovered in, I believe it was April or May, the principal of the school, Sister Mary Margaret Kuiper, she retired as the principal. She's 77 years old. She'd been there for 29 years. And so with a change of staff coming in, they did a routine audit to prepare for the new principal. And about the same time, a parent requested a copy of an old check and got to looking at it and realized that the account on this check was not the school's account. The nuns allegedly had been putting the money in another church account. It was associated with the church, but it had been long forgotten. So it was essentially being used as a personal account. It was a church account, so it had a similar name, and it kind of went under the radar until this parent noticed the numbers were off.
So I guess now they're doing some forensic accounting and trying to figure out how much of that money was diverted to that account. Meanwhile, the nuns, when parents would say, well, can we have money for new school uniforms or better textbooks, they would cry poverty and say, well, the school has no money.
That's correct. I spoke to one father who said, for years, he said, I never seemed to have any $5 or $10 bills because we were always giving. Meanwhile, the students ate lunch every day in an outdoor space, and parents asked for an awning to cover their children every year, and the nuns would say there's not enough money for that. So just basic needs for the school. People mentioned basketball uniforms. There was no air conditioning. So there was always a sense that the school was struggling financially. And so the parents, of course, are very, very upset about that.
And did they spend all the money in Vegas, or were they buying other things?
It's unclear. The church and the school are being very careful about how they word these things. It's the parents, actually, who are saying that they spoke openly about trips to Vegas and Lake Tahoe. The school and the church itself have not directly linked the spending to Las Vegas specifically. An attorney for the Archdiocese has said, they were known to travel, they were known to gamble, but they have not come out and said they specifically spent this money on those trips. So it's a nuance, but they're being really careful with the wording. So it's unclear, what percentage of that went toward the gambling or the home that they lived in. It's a little unclear at this point.
Are they going to face criminal charges?
At this point, the Archdiocese has—they changed their mind this week. Initially, they were going to simply investigate this internally. They said they would not press criminal charges, but once the figure rose and rose, the Archdiocese told me this week that they had had a promise from the nuns' order that they belonged to. They were going to repay it. The number has grown so large at this point that's getting more and more difficult. And so the Archdiocese has said they're cooperating with police, and they will be a complaining party to a criminal lawsuit.
Okay.
The investigation's ongoing, but the Archdiocese has said now that they will cooperate.
LA Times Metro reporter Haley Branson Potts, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that will do it for us today. I have an end-of-show note. As you know, we've been hit by some terrible wildfires this year. And as we get drier and hotter, it's just going to get worse. We're going to be talking about that at a town hall tonight. And you can attend. We'd love to have you at KCRW's new headquarters. It's free. The show starts at 8 o'clock, and you can RSVP at kcrw.com/events. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.